Blog Talk Radio.
All right, listen to The Unknown Show. I'm your host, Bud Smith. On tonight's show, we're going to talk to Jen Knox, and we're also going to talk to Lindsay Thomas about her new book, Blind Date at the Glass Eye Disco, from Cleftjaw Press. All right, thanks for listening. It's another Tuesday night. We should have a pretty good show here tonight. We're going to talk to Jen Knox. She's a great writer. It always seems to really knock me out. She's a teacher at Bennington College, and she works in creative. She's a creative writing professor, and her work just pops up all over the place, Pank, and different really just cool spots. After her, we're going to talk to Lindsay Thomas, who's got a new novella that's out. It's a stripper memoir about her time as being a stripper and other things. And now she'll be on the line later telling us about that. And we're going to jump right into the first caller here. Okay, so I got a 614 caller. Hello? You're
hey,
on the air,
bud.
614?
Jen.
How you doing, Jen? I wasn't sure if it was you or somebody else. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good, pretty good. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah. Where are you calling from?
San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, nice. What's it like down there right now?
Hot, and the air is filled with allergens. It's really beautiful.
That's good. Like, can you just, are the allergens so thick you can just, like, see them floating around or not quite?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah?
They kind of, like, wrap around you like a hug, you know?
Oh.
no, actually, we had some kind of weird African dust, I guess,
loop
in here. And so the allergies are just really, really bad. So, I don't know, something about the wind patterns or something. But usually it's not bad here. It's a pretty little town, so.
Cool. Are you
New Jersey?
Yeah, I'm from New Jersey, and I live in New York City. So,
you're in New York City. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, I'm in New York City. I live way uptown, though. I live by the George Washington Bridge and Yankee Stadium. So I don't know if you've ever been up to the city. It's kind of a little bit out of the way, but it's definitely still got a city feel up here.
Yeah, and everything's, you know, pretty close, too, if you wanted to travel around a little bit. That's really cool. I've only been to New York once, and I was in Manhattan, and it was amazing. So I need to go back soon.
Yeah, I mean, it always seems, it seems like there's people come here often, they go read at KGB. Maybe you ought to go and do something like that, you know? Some of these great readings.
That's what I was
downtown.
There for KGB. Yeah.
Yeah?
But so now I just need to go back.
When did you read there?
It was a lot of fun. It was September last year. Yeah, and it was just,
oh, okay.
It was really awesome. I read with Joni and Susan Tepper, you know, she MC for us. It was really amazing. So
yeah,
it's a cool
Susan's
little bar.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
I was just talking to her, her earlier today. I guess they're, not to get off topic here to other people, but I guess they're mostly those same ladies are converging there again in like maybe a month or some shit. You see that?
Oh, yeah. I've been seeing posts for that. Yeah, it's going to be great. I know Jesse Alvarez is reading, and I think Roberto. Yeah, it's going to be a good show, though. It definitely will. So, are you going to go?
So, yeah, I'm going to go. I mean, it's great. Awesome. It's great when people come to New York and I can visit them.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we could talk about other people for hours here. But
True.
I'm curious what you have going on. I was reading your bio,
mm-hmm.
which I was reading, and I wasn't reading it out loud. So people listening, if you guys are familiar with Jen, Jen Knox, the Jen Knox. She just has some great writing that's it just pops up all over the place. And you're the winner of the 2000. I don't mean to embarrass you. You're the winner of the 2011 Next Generation Indie Book Award in Short Fiction, and the Reader's Favorite Award in Women's Fiction. And she's a contributing author to the Short Story America Anthology, which is that's fucking cool. Yeah. And you have a chapbook forthcoming from Monkey Puzzle Press. What can you tell us about that chapbook?
Oh, yeah, I'm really excited about that. It's called Don't Tease the Elephants. And the namesake story actually appeared in Monkey Bicycle magazine. So that could be confusing. This guy, and actually... I might read a little bit from it later if we had time, but this guy just keeps popping up.
Got all the time in the world.
Awesome. Yeah, it's one of those things where you don't really intend to, but this character just keeps coming back, you know, in various ways. Sometimes as a secondary character, sometimes kind of as the main character. Just keeps coming back, and so I've got that kind of going on with this character. And two of his stories are in this chapbook. So I'm pretty excited about it.
What's the character's name?
Oh, Rattle. Like a rattlesnake.
Oh, cool. His name's that badass, Rattle. That's nice. So, yeah, it's it must sound strange for, I don't mean to say, like, the average writer or the average reader or somebody thinking about putting out their own book. And then when you say your book's coming out, your chapbook's coming out a full year from now, and I remember when I first heard that, I was like, oh my god, these authors, they get something accepted somewhere, and then it takes a fucking year, but
yeah.
I mean, being involved with it, making books for other people, and then doing my own books and having other presses do it, you need all that time. It's no
joke.
Oh
yeah, you do. You need the distance, too, because, you know, when you have that space from the project, you can go back and look at it a few months later and be, whoa, I have some stuff to do to this, you know?
Yeah.
Or, you know, just to present it the best possible way. And and I think that's something that almost all authors have to learn kind of the hard way, you know, in one way or another, you know, just sharing a story a little bit too fast or something to that effect. I've definitely been there. Hey, congratulations on Soul Booth. I'm going to buy a signed copy. Looks awesome.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I was just, I got a big box of books in the mail today, and I'm just starting to, they showed up, you know, so they're sitting in my apartment, and I'm looking at them, I'm like, you know, but, I mean, you know, the shit, it takes so long, you know, it's like, well, what we just talked about, you know, you write something, and really the best thing you can ever do is walk away from it for a while. And because I swear to God, people, if I meet a writer, just not that I'm saying I'm just starting out too, but I'm saying if I meet somebody who's really, really just starting out, and they tell me that their first or second draft is really awesome, and I'm like, it's awesome now, but you know, when you read it in a year, you'll really wish you had another chance to do another draft on it. So that's why it's cool to step away from something.
It is. It's not easy, though. A lot of times, you know, it's kind of like breaking up a romance because you're just really in love with that piece. And I don't know. In my experience, the more in love I am with it, the more I need distance from it.
Yeah.
Because usually the more stuff is going on that really shouldn't be, or, you know, not enough stuff going on that should be.
Well, I got to say, you seem fairly prolific, which is always something I admire in a writer. And it's funny to call, you know, if you call somebody prolific and they're a writer, it sounds okay, but it's really silly if you call, like, a plumber prolific or if you call a carpenter prolific, you know, like, how many toilets did you put in this year, you know, or whatever. But it's great because putting out a lot of work, it kind of really, it seems to lend itself to that whole idea of, I want to be creative. I want to do the creative thing, but you can also walk away from projects and let them mature a little bit behind the scenes. Let them kind of cook, right?
Yeah, that's the best way for me to get away from a story and to give it some breathing room is to start something new right away. you know, even if I don't feel like it or whatever. So, yeah, that's been the secret, you know, to me. And I think maybe that's why I've been able to do a lot, because it's definitely not because I have, you know, a lot of free time or anything. So, but I think it's just like it's welcome distraction, and then maybe that'll end up being something as well. But.
Can you, I usually don't like to do this. I usually don't like to ask people to talk about, like, their process or whatever, but I'm kind of curious with you. What's, you know, this is the out of the blue, I'll harass you with this lame question. What's your process for writing, like, generally speaking? Where do you write, how do you write, and where's it go?
So I have a little apartment, and we have a little office set up, and so basically I'll, you know, get everything set up in my office, and I'll sit down like I'm going to write, and then I never do. But I tend to write everywhere else, like, you know, like on the couch, you know, I start a story, you know, when I was sitting down to watch Breaking Bad or something, and I'm on the porch just like talking to someone, like, oh, wait, hold on a minute, because I have an idea, you know. So, I mean, I am kind of, you know, it does kind of start, you know, just whenever it starts, but I'm one of those writers that I kind of have an idea, like I see something or I hear something, usually something that makes me angry, actually. And then I just kind of let it sit and I try to figure it out, you know, like a puzzle or whatever. And then, you know, it, in my head. And then, you know, usually a story starts to develop, or something does, or an idea that I can explore. And then I just sit down and try to write out a whole draft. And, you know, I can't really wait for the mood, you know, necessarily. But I usually just kind of, like, I get in that writing space and I just go. So it's usually, you know, like, after work, staying up too late, when I have to work the next day, or, you know, when I'm supposed to be grading papers or something to that effect. So, and that's how it goes. And then usually, I'm usually not very good at letting it sit for too long. If that first draft, I usually start revising right away, you know. I just feel compelled to, but then I try so really hard. Sometimes I do, you know, have that, oh, I love it, you know, type of thing going on. But I've been getting better and better as the years go by of being patient, and then just trying to, like, start something else or read news stories and try to look for, you know, ideas and see if anything hits me. So.
Yeah. Do you have that story or that whatever it is, piece of little essay or article or whatever that when you wrote it, you were like, this is the fucking best thing I've ever done. And then you just never find a home for it. That you can never find anybody to publish it that you would want to publish. I mean, you know.
Yeah. Actually, it has been kind of like that now where I'm, I don't know, it's kind of controversial, I guess. And I really think it's a good story. And I'm not letting go of it, that it's a good story, but I think that it's a tough topic. So I keep letting it rest a little bit, looking at it, and then sending it out again. And I don't know, I'm hoping it'll find a home, but it's possible I'm in that, you know, romance period. Who knows? Because when you are, you know, it's, like, hard to tell. So, I've had stories spinning around for, you know, a little while, like, you know, quite a few months, and pretty much completed, you know. So so we'll see what happens with that. I'll be screaming from the mountaintops when I do ever, you know, find it a home, that's for sure.
Oh, I know. It's a funny thing having this stuff sit around. I wrote a story one time about a guy who starts hearing like Simon and Garfunkel songs everywhere he goes.
Definitely.
And I was like, oh my god, man, this is the best idea ever. And all it is he just hears a shitload of Simon and Garfunkel songs, and it, like, kind of drives him crazy. And that's, like, that was the whole story. But at the time I was like, this is gonna change. Well, it's like changing his life, but. And then I wrote another one where the whole point of the story was a guy gets stabbed in the head with a pair of scissors. Sometimes it's really great to have shit that gets rejected and never picked up, because you're like, wow, I'm glad the fucking story about the guy that gets stabbed in the head with the pair of scissors didn't go anywhere, because I don't even want to read that.
Yeah. And you don't want to have to try to bury the work somewhere. Yeah. But I don't know. I think it sounds like your process is kind of a lot like mine, where you start with like an idea, you know, and then you build off of it, as opposed to, or a character or something happening, you know, as opposed to sitting down and outlining and, you know, I don't know. Do you outline?
I'm not very good at outlining short stories.
Yeah.
But I really have gotten into the habit of outlining novels. I got a few things floating around, you know, like everybody, and I really, really fell in love with the whole outlining process. I was kind of doing it in a different way. I'll tell you real quick what it is. I like to write on my phone at work. So I'll have like I have maybe 45 minutes during the course of the day where I can write on my phone, you know? Just with my thumbs, right in the notepad on my iPhone.
That's impressive.
So,
by the way,
thank you. But if you do it every day for 45 minutes, Jesus Christ, you really have you got a lot of stuff to work with there. But it's a little harder to edit it because it's obviously more typo prone. But anyway, so what I did recently with outlining was I broke up. I figured out what my kind of word output was for a day. It was about maybe 1,500 words, 1,600 words. I was writing that on an index card for the novel, and I would break it up into, I knew it was going to be 30 sections of 1,500 words. And so I just did a rough, quick outline, like bullet point things, and took a photo of each one. So now when I'm at work, I have it on my phone. You know, I can just look and say, okay, today's assignment is chapter 23. Dog falls in a well, and the dog's up there trying to save him, or whatever. And
that's a
cool.
good way to do it. Yeah, I mean, because a novel is a whole different animal. It's so big and looming, and if you don't break it down into digestible chunks, it's like, I don't know. For me, at least, like I started a novel quite some time ago, and I'm just now finishing it. But I actually sat down and I kind of wrote it all out. Honestly, pretty much like just day after day wrote it all out. But then it made no sense. Like it was kind of like, you know, just random words on a page.
And as a lot, all of a sudden, I found when I didn't do just a little bit of outlining, I found that I would all of a sudden have the main character's girlfriend be a different name and his dog's a different color. And then all of a sudden the place where he works is something different. And that's all fine and well, but... And that sucks. That sucks for, you know, whoever's going to copy edit it
God
forbid if you copy edit it yourself.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's, you know, I mean, that process is so individual, but I definitely, you know, like when I wrote all that out and I saw, you know, well, I don't really have anything coherent here, you know, I had to go back and instead of just pitching it, like I went ahead and did kind of what you did. I actually did index cards and got a whiteboard for my little office and, you know, mapped it out. And then I just did, like a chapter a day, and I sat down and I just, you know, got from point A to point B. But I almost think like, I think it was a good combination of just like, you know, writing a whole lot, just getting it out, and then you have your idea there in that raw form, and then going through and, like, just doing some hardcore, like, writing, revising, like, you know, a lot of mine was just rewriting and, you know, writing these scenes completely anew, but it works.
Yeah.
It works. It's encouraging because that novel, man, whew, that was tough.
I think it gets easier the more you do, you know, because now you kind of have a feel for everybody who, when they do one, you know, you get a feel for it and feel it out. But yeah, I think the best way for, I don't know, for anybody is like you said, just write the thing out. I don't know if I agree with, I do the NaNoWrite thing, but I don't know if I agree with it. It has to be 30 days. I think that's a little daunting. Realistically, you know, you can do it, but I think 45 days for that amount of words is totally
Yeah,
doable.
Maybe if you're at a writing retreat, you know, in, I don't know, Paris or something, maybe you can do it, but that's kind of hard for people that, you know,
Well, if anybody wants to write a novel in 45 days, they can come work with me at the oil refinery, and we'll write together on our lunch breaks in our stinky oil smelling clothes, and we'll keep our hard hats on and our steel toed boots, and we'll work on our crappy novels that we think are awesome together. You know, the invitation is open for anybody who wants to sign up for that.
I'm sure that you'll be getting bombarded with emails.
Yes.
Oh man. Especially if it's as hot there as it is here, and you're working.
It sucks here, all the humidity and stuff. But I'm not one to complain. So your the novel you're working on, I'm seeing right here. Let's see, is that the Getaway State? No,
that's actually. Yeah, short stories. It's called We Arrive Uninvited.
That's a novel.
And yeah, yeah. It's loosely based on my grandmother's life, and it's she has a schizophrenia, and when I was growing up, I kind of romanticized it, and when I was a kid, I was thinking, like, she just knew things the rest of the world didn't. And then the more I thought about that, I was like, you know, even as an adult, I'm like, maybe that's true. I don't know. Like, maybe there's something in her that's keyed into something the rest of us don't see, you know. And obviously, maybe the messages are misinterpreted or, you know. So anyway, just that kind of romanticizing of something so, you know, obviously painful to her, but also in a way kind of that freed her from certain aspects of life because she just didn't. She didn't see things the way other people did, you know, and she was more romantic, you know. So anyway, I decided to take that and then write basically but I wanted to write from the young girl's perspective who doesn't really believe that her grandmother's ill, but rather gifted, and how she goes to break her grandmother out of a mental institution and she skips school to do this. And then when she gets there, she starts to hear her stories. And the grandmother tells her stories bit by bit, and the chapters start to alternate between the girl's coming of age and the grandmother's story, which is nothing short of a fairy tale. Like, it's out there, a crazy fairy tale. And then she has to, like, determine, like, what of it's real, you know, and what of it is an illness, or is it an illness, you know? So anyway, I just thought the concept really drove it. It was not easy to write, but I'm pretty proud of it, and I think eventually I'll get that polished up and out there in the world. So
I bet you will. It sounds like a fucking hell of a book. It really does. I mean, I love the idea, the whole juxtaposition between, real life, this sense seems like the little girl's reality, and all the magic of the schizophrenic old woman. That's fucking great.
Yeah, I there's a lot of stuff out there about mental illness, and I mean, I've written about it quite a bit, and it's a lot of times it's sad, or it's, you know, and so I kind of just wanted to look at it from a different perspective, more of a curious perspective, and, you know. So maybe a magical perspective, but yeah, we'll see what happens.
I love hearing that word of somebody describing it's obviously literary fiction. I love hearing somebody say magic, because I think it's, it's a word that kind of makes some people cringe, but I love it. I've been knee deep in it lately too. And, I see some more of it popping up all around, you know, more than usual. And Jen Mikowski just put out The Tide King. Have you read that yet?
I haven't. That is, like, on the top of my list, though.
Yeah, it's on the top of my list, too. I heard her read an excerpt. Here we are, jumping up, talking about somebody else. But I heard her read an excerpt from The Tide King at the Sunday Salon reading, Sarah Lipman. And just that reading down in the village on Sunday nights in once a month. Anyway, they were all of a sudden in this World War II biop, or whatever it is, biop, there's this magical herb that can save someone's life. And I was like, oh my God, that's so awesome. I want a little more magic, you know?
Cool. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of cool to weave that into the more literary work that sometimes so like heavy and tough to take,
yeah.
even though it's beautiful in its own way. Sometimes it's good
yeah.
to, yeah, put a little mystery in there or something. But,
yeah, exactly. I don't know. That's kind of where the story come from. That's where it originally, what people wanted to hear. They wanted to hear about the super unrealistic, you know, entertaining,
right.
You know, the Odyssey, all that old stuff. But and now it all sucks. You can say like, oh, nobody wants to read about fucking vampires and shit. Well, that's because the writing is terrible. If somebody who was really good.
Are they
still on
vampires? Really?
They're still on vampires, and they keep getting glittery.
Yeah.
They keep more and more glitter smeared all over themselves and shit. And you know, I mean, come on, I want to read. I want to read something about a high school principal who's a werewolf. But somebody do it good or something. I don't know. Whatever.
Right.
So yeah,
well,
there's your next idea for your next book. It can be a werewolf private investigator or something.
Oh,
sure.
Yes, totally. I'm on board. Yeah. Hey, if I can make that good, though, you know, that'd be pretty impressive. I'd be pretty proud of that. Yeah, there's a lot out there that's a lot out there.
Yeah, there's a lot. But we can make fun of people all for the rest of the night. That's another easy topic. So I want to talk too. You have a collection of short stories that you have completed, and that
mm-hmm.
gets me excited because it's called The Getaway State. And why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
So that's all interlinked stories, but they're very loosely interlinked. It's just I'm from Ohio. And so Ohio, you know, is kind of hurting right now in general, but especially areas like Toledo and, you know, certain areas that I grew up going to a lot, and, you know, maybe even living in. I think that there's a real survival culture going on. Like, for instance, right now, the job market's like crazy hard. It's really hard to get a job there, and which is why we moved to San Antonio, actually, my husband and I, because we just looked and looked and looked, and we both, you know, he had just finished grad school, and I was almost, you know, I was about to, and, I mean, it was just nothing, you know, desert, but I think that, you know, a lot of, you know, you know, if you stay there and you say, you know, there's a Midwestern mentality and there's a kind of cool grit to, you know, the culture there. And I really love it, you know. And so I like to write with that setting. And then my characters, I just kind of wrote most all these stories, except for maybe the last two or three, just on their own, you know, just they were their own entities. And they just all happened to be in Ohio. And then I started, like, noticing that some of the characters were weaving in, and not just Rattle, but, you know, a lot of different ones. And so I kind of, you know, just elaborated on that even more. And so now these characters are popping up, but not in a forced way, but just almost in a kind of like, oh, that guy crossing the street is that guy that, you know, we heard about last week, you know, like, so it's just kind of like you're actually living there and, like, interacting with these folks. And you know, and I call it the getaway state because, you know, when I was there, it was like everybody was trying to find jobs and get away, you know? And I don't know. I think it's good, you know, I think it's going to get better, you know? There's a revitalization around the corner. There has to be, but yeah, I love that culture. So.
I love that culture, and I love, this is a whole other can of worms, what you just talked about right now, the linked short story book, the idea of all of a sudden that, you know, different places, people, and plots maybe even kind of intertwined in unexpected ways, and that's like something that really interests me, and that's like a whole different it's a whole different art form right there, because it's like short stories stand alone by themselves, novels, whatever, but there's a whole nother door you open there with that.
Well, I mean, I teach creative writing, and the one thing I always tell my students is if they have a story, they have to let go. There might be something in that story that they can build off in another story, or, you know,
yeah.
like there's nothing wasted in writing really, because it's all working up to, you know, our collective works, you know, when we eventually do stop writing, you know, if we just keep going and going and going, you know, it builds and it grows exponentially, and, you know, there it all starts to interlink, and, you know, the same themes start to come up. It's just really cool. It's really cool.
It is really cool.
I think
yeah. I remember when I first, it's a pretty mainstream way of coming across this, but I remember the first time I came across that in a book was reading Kurt Vonnegut. And all of a sudden, you know, you realize reading wherever you start, all of a sudden you read another one and you're like, oh, wow, Kilgore Trout's in this one too. And then before you know it, there's like all these characters that kind of intertwine in through the books, and even some plot, different plot lines that are all through the books.
Yeah.
It just makes you want to read everything.
Exactly. As a reader, it's so gratifying. You're like, oh, I've got a corner,
yeah.
I've got, you know, something to hold on to, you know, and
yeah.
it makes me feel like part of the story. Yeah, it's really cool. Really cool.
Which is really cool. Why you mentioned, like, everybody's thing that they're into right now. It seems like, I'm surprised at the ratings of Breaking Bad, that, like, you hear people talking about it all the time, Breaking Bad. But then
mm-hmm.
you hear the ratings aren't as high as
executives
and all this shit. They're not, but it's like a cultural phenomenon almost, with the resurgence of great writing that can be on TV. People are like, holy shit, you can put a slow, long story on TV and people will fucking freak out about it, because you're actually writing about these characters that are undergoing a transformation, one for the better, one for the worse,
I'm impressed with the audiences that do, because it seemed like there was absolutely none of that before. I think the first one that really got me was 6 Feet Under, which was quite a while ago, and I came to it late, but man, the writing in that was just awesome. And I didn't really see anything else like it, you know?
Yeah.
And now it's like one after
it's
another popping up, and
yeah, all these shows.
Yeah.
So listen, I really would love if you would read some stuff before I pull our next guest on. No time limit here. Read anything you'd like. I'd love to hear. We were talking earlier about some poems from your chapbook. Do you have any of them you'd like to read?
I only have stories. I'm trying to see here.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't. Well, see, you're throwing me off because you say chapbook. That's like New Jersey. That's an ignorant guy from New Jersey thing. Stories, poems, I'm down for anything, obviously.
All right.
I'm just dumbing, I'm just dumbing from New Jersey.
I'm okay on time here, right? Because I don't want to...
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, all the time in the world.
Okay. So I'll just read, I guess this is like two and a half pages. I'll just read a short story with that guy Rattle in it.
Yeah,
and this will be in Don't Tease the Elephant. It's entitled Nothing. Another rattle arrives with each new skin. We called him Rattle because he spent a summer somewhere in Arizona catching and saddling rattlesnakes with tracking devices. He said that each snake maintains a territory of about 5 miles and that they all respect each other's boundaries until congregating for communal hibernation. Any odd job you could think of, he's at it. Rattle worked as a cashier at the McDonald's downtown, 2 grocery stores, the Hardware on Morris, a club on Summit. He worked as a security guard at a bank, then a baseball game, and as a maintenance man and a janitor, and as an animal tracker. He sold weed for a while around 4th, did some carpentry, some sales, even some babysitting. I heard that he was unemployed now. So when I saw him at the bar and he offered to buy me a beer, I refused. Rattle was a sort of local celebrity. He was the guy everyone talked about as they led their own boring lives. I offered to buy his drink instead, lying about having just closed a big deal at work. He said he wanted scotch. Rattle had shoulder-length brown hair and a goatee dusted gray. He'd been doing odd construction jobs outside of town, he said, and it was paying the bills. He had some expensive work to get done on his bike, but he knew a guy. His small talk sounded like a movie script. I hung on every word. I looked to his hands. meaty and red, but not calloused. And I nodded along. Here I was, buying scotch for the man the whole of our little Midwestern town talked about over squarish bottles of Fiji. "So you're a big deal," he said, raising his glass. He laughed, looking around. "You know, the last time I was here, there was a party for me. I closed the place down and had some girls from Brights come in and dance. I got 2 tattoos that night. One's kind of messed up." "Yeah, I heard about that party, man. Heard you were in town. Wednesdays are early for me at the office, or I would have come out, crashed." I was rambling. Ridiculous. I wanted to direct the focus back to him, so I asked, "What's the tattoo?" "Taking the shirt off, boss," he said to Ernie, the owner, who was related to Rattle in some way and had probably been the one to throw the party. Ernie looked around the bar for customers who might make a big deal about a guy taking off the shirt, and, finding none, he nodded. When the black T-shirt was lifted, revealing a 6-days-a-week-at-the-gym body, I felt the urge to touch his abs to see if they were real. He had a line of text in the half moon above his belly button that said, "Nothing can be a real cool hand," in plain font like Arial, the only one we're allowed to use at work. "Cool hand Luke," I said, a little more excited than I meant to sound. I watched the movie any chance I got, which wasn't often. Usually, I watched it when I was sick and no one was home. My wife was tired of it. My teenage daughter said it was lame. "I bet no one has that tattoo," I said, wishing I'd thought of it. "Yeah," he said, "but I was drunk. I was really drunk." "What's wrong with it?" "Tattoos are scripture, man. They can limit you. Anytime you get inked, it's like tracing a line on a road map that shows you where you're going." He put back the scotch in a way people aren't supposed to put back scotch. I offered to buy another. "I like that one," I said, pointing to a woman tattooed on his arm, built like a Barbie and dressed like she worked at Bright's. "That one was no picnic," he said, "my first wife." I didn't know what to say. I wanted to know more about the Barbie wife who was no picnic because I'd never heard about him getting married. You'd think people would have known and gossiped about it. It was probably a 2-day marriage like celebrities get in Vegas in the heat of the moment. I wanted to ask, but he didn't look like he wanted to talk about it. "I'm 42, he said. "I want what you have." I thought about my office job, my carpal tunnel, and the splint I had to wear nightly. I thought about how my wife hardly let me touch her and how I hardly wanted to. I thought about my daughter calling my wife a bitch and telling her to calm her tits before running out the door and driving away a few days ago. And how I smelled wine on her breath when she returned, but I was too tired to confront her about it. I thought about how I always left it to my wife to punish her because I simply couldn't stand to see my daughter upset. "I don't know, man. You seem to have a lot more freedom," I said. He didn't respond. I was drinking beer, but I was drinking fast enough for it to feel like the hard stuff. I usually had two, even on the weekend, but it was Friday and the wife had her yoga. I didn't really want to be there when she got home because if I was, she'd ask me why I didn't take out the trash or do the dishes or both. I put my hand on Rattle's forearm and felt its hardness. I wished it was my own forearm. I caught myself and awkwardly patted it a few times before saying, "How hot were those girls from Brights? I heard they wear some kind of paint that makes certain parts of their body glow in the dark." "Yeah, that was kind of cool," he said. He began sipping his third scotch. He looked at me, studied me, looked so deeply into my eyes I thought he could crawl inside. He spoke carefully and said, "You know, the girl told me she was 18, and I believed her because she was dancing, and they're supposed to be 18, legal." He was full of genuine compassion. He was not empty, not nothing. He was genuinely hurting, and I felt for him. "What happened? You got a case?" I asked. "You can't trust those girls. They lie." "Look, man, just know I'm sorry," he said. He pushed a 50 across the bar toward Ernie and gave me a look when I tried to protest that shut me down. "I'll be around when you want to kick my ass. I don't think you can do it, but I owe you enough to let you try." I didn't find out about my daughter's pregnancy until a week later, when I found her crying in her room because she was afraid. She kept saying that God was punishing her and her life was over, and I asked her where she got such an idea. "It's my own fault, Dad. I have to feel this terrible for a reason." I wanted to ask her what her motivation had been to dance, but I couldn't think about it, let alone see her upset. You'll be fine, I said. It was all I could think to say. She described Rattle to me as though I didn't know who he was, and I acted as though I really didn't because I could get away with this. My daughter thought I was just a working stiff, someone completely disconnected with the life outside our home, the life of motorcycles and bars and strip clubs that prey on underage girls. I didn't know how to discipline her at the time. I wasn't angry, only sad. My wife, on the other hand, was well-equipped to deal. She sent our daughter to a sort of scared straight program that did exactly that. She was gone all summer and came back wanting to be a social worker or a nurse. While she was gone, I worked the legal route and had my colleague recommend a good lawyer. I had the police visit the club. I had it shut down. This is the kind of thing I knew how to do. The night of the confession, that last night I saw Rattle, he had told me that although snakes can seem intimidating, they're really vulnerable. Few animals have so many predators. He had a rattlesnake tattooed on his back that he got after working that summer in Arizona. He said every year he lives, he adds a rattle. They get louder as they get older, but that's unnecessarily good, he said. It's just noise. Rattle revved his motorcycle that night as I stood at my Toyota, wondering if I should call a cab. I watched as he went roaring into the dark, into the nothing.
That's really something else there.
Thanks. Yeah, that Rattle guy's popping up all over the place, but he's never, like, narrating, so I don't know.
Good.
We'll see what happens.
That's good. It keeps the mystery alive, you know?
Yeah.
Is that story running anywhere? Is it online anywhere for people to reread?
Yeah, it's actually in Unia Ian Chung. It's online. It's up there with another story I wrote called Rita Forgives the World. And so that was just posted a few months ago. So.
Oh, really?
Send me
the link, and I'll put it up on the Facebook wall. I think people look at that. I don't know. and they can click. Yeah, people share shit. Who knows? And I want to thank you for coming on the show. It was great to talk to you and hear about your cool process for stuff, you know?
Yeah, it was good talking to you, too. Have a good... A good week, and I'll be listening in to the rest of the show.
All right. Ken Knox, everybody. all right. Coming up next, we have Lindsay Thomas. I believe this is Lindsay Thomas. I usually stare at a list of callers here. It's just numbers, so I never know. And I never do the research ahead of time to see what people's fucking numbers are. Is this Lindsay? Lindsay, are you there?
505?
505 or 505?
Do you
you're
have 505?
505.
505.
Caller, 505.
How are you doing, bud?
Great. I need like a screener who's like, "Yes, Roots the Unknown Show. Do you have a question for Bud Smith?" And then you like say some bullshit. You're like, "Yeah, I'm looking for like some kind of great adult diapers, and I was gonna ask the Bud, and he knows whatever it is." but no, it's just me here. Ambling, just aimless. How you doing over there?
I really enjoyed your interview there. I was listening in. And
that's great stuff.
I love that story.
She's a little whirlwind, and somebody we can all learn from. Hey, she actually gives these great online creative writing classes. I believe so.
She does online classes?
I think she does. I think she had one over the summer. And,
I would take her class if I was in the market to do such a thing.
Yes. So what's your dilly tonight? What are you up to?
Well, I was actually going to lay down and take a nap until about 7:45 or so, but then Frankie came and knocked on the door and said that I needed to be on the show right now because you're on East Coast time.
Did he threaten you? Did he threaten you with, like, horrible things?
just a little bit. Nothing too harsh.
So for everybody listening, all eight of you, on the air is Lindsay Thomas. She's the author of the
great new novella from Clefjaw Press, and I know it's great because I've read it like four times. Really, I've read it four times. Doing the copy editing and stuff on it, helping out Clefjaw with that. And Lindsay is married to Frankie Metro, who's a poet friend of mine. But who cares about Frankie? We're talking about you and your fucking badass book tonight, Blind Date at the Glass Eye Disco. You want to tell me and the other eight people what it's about?
Well, you said it was a stripper memoir, but actually I wanted to say it is a spiritual journey disguised as the account of an unsuccessful attempt to write a stripper memoir.
Well, that's exactly what it is. But when you only have like a 2-second attention span of the average adult human on the planet, I have to say stripper as quick as I can and get over with it, you know?
Yeah, I'm afraid to call it that because, you know,
it's
that
not
kind
really
of
that at
pigeonholes
all.
It. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
easy to think so with the giant monster stripper on the cover. So I'm still working out how to explain it to people because it's just such a weird story. I don't know.
It is a weird story. It starts out, it's a little girl growing up surrounded by pretty much, almost, I'd say, religious extremists. You can go that far with it. And just kind of her kind of rebellions. Why don't you kind of walk people through what happens in the book loosely so they can kind of get a bearing on what we're talking about.
At first, the book kind of opens up with this fake satanic priest named Mike Warnke, who's a real guy who... that part came directly from a real experience that I had when I was in junior high about. I went to this church, and we went to see this guy, and he was billed as a Christian comedian, and he would give his testimony, and he just said some really, really wild stuff that even though I was a kid, I was like, why aren't you in a penitentiary right now? And... So, but, I mean, he found Jesus, of course, and, you know,
yeah.
It was a pretty, pretty interesting thing. And then I didn't think about it for years and years, and then all of a sudden he popped into my head, and I was like, wow, is that real?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I looked the guy up, and I remember he had a book, and I think I actually had it. And so
yeah.
I was just tripping out one day, going on Amazon and reading all the reviews of this book that he wrote called The Satan Seller. And so about a decade after he wrote that, he was exposed by, Cornerstone Christian Magazine as a fraud. He just made it all up. But, I mean, a lot of people still really love him and are still telling him how he changed their lives and whatnot. So it's kind of funny. So starts out there and then... really, the main character just keeps going into all of these different churches and has all of these bizarre things going on at the church. And she kind of questions it, and it caused a lot of conflict between her and her family.
Yeah.
And eventually she just, like, kind of gives up on them and is like, okay, fuck you people. And she runs away and gets pregnant and, you know, just... Everything just goes horribly wrong, and then from there she has these really ridiculous experiences in strip clubs in different parts of the United States and Guam.
Yeah, I actually, the other day, I worked with this guy. He was in the Air Force, and the first day I met this guy, he told me, he goes, I want to write a book about my life, and I was like, motherfucker. I gotta hear this one more time. Somebody, the first day I meet them, they say they want to write a book about their life. But anyway, so he gets in all this stuff, and he really does have a crazy life that somebody should write a book about. But he went to Guam, and he was telling me all about it. Like, I'd be surprised about the details. And I was like, actually, sir, I just read a fucking amazing spiritual journey stripper memoir novella that was highly comical and about fake Satan priests and. You know, living in the Southwest with, and he was like, okay, so you know, fuck Guam, that's awesome. And then he told me a story about how he shot somebody in the head one time and went to jail for 5 years. I was like, yes, keep going.
So you're going to write a book about him?
I'm not, no. I'm not writing a book about any person alive or dead or resembles that in any way. All of my work is it's all a product of my own imagination, and not to be confused, as originally stated by me and my lawyers, as the representative of anyone living or dead.
Me too.
Nice.
Yeah.
So we're doing good then.
Yeah.
So you got this book that just popped up. Maybe, what's it been, like 2 weeks? And it must feel good. It must feel good, right?
Yeah, it's weird because I'm not published all that much as far as around the internet even.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know, I'm on like Unlikely Stories and I was on Red Fez and different things, but I've been wanting to finish a book for a long time, and I don't think I could have done it without Frankie to be the editor, drill sergeant, you know, kind of direct my shit.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing with doing a book, you know, and kind of teaming up with a good editor really makes it something different, makes it a whole different ballgame. So I gotta say, I had the privilege of reading with you in Albuquerque. Well, you know, a poetry reading thing, and I want to describe to everybody listening what happened at the reading, because it was fucking hilarious. I remember you got up on stage and you had all these paintings with you, and a few of them I think are actually in the book now, aren't they? They're paintings of a unicorn vomiting a rainbow or something. Correct me if I'm wrong, either. So you got up on stage and started telling everybody that you quit writing poetry and you're now a painter, and you were going to auction off your paintings one by one to the highest bidder. And it was fucking hilarious. Well, I think we got a problem with the connection here. So a little bit of technical difficulties. I'm going to play a song. Everybody stay tuned.
Hello,
you're back. Got a little bit of a musical accompaniment now. I just warmed my my backing band up. Is your phone connection all working good now?
Hello,
can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Sorry about that.
That's all right. Yeah, I was just kind of talking about you got up on stage and you were telling everybody in the audience that you weren't a poet anymore and now you were a painter and you were going to auction off all your paintings, and you had the unicorn vomiting a rainbow, and I think you had your painting of Satan at the time.
Yep.
Do you remember all of them?
See, I do. I have it's Jesus, who's stroking a unicorn's horn.
Yeah.
Glitter Satan, which I recently left with Aurora Kill Poet in Oakland, or Redwood City. And the vomiting sun picture has a rainbow.
Oh, it was the sun. It was the sun vomiting. I've seen that picture probably about 1,000 times, and now it just becomes all different kinds of things to me. It's like, you know, the earth vomiting rainbow. Unicorn vomiting rainbow, skull vomiting rainbow.
I do like the unicorn vomiting a rainbow, but I think probably somebody's already made that, huh?
Yeah, you could have it like, I don't know. You could have a unicorn like jumping over a shark or something.
Yeah.
So what's next?
Yeah,
do you have a book release party coming up for Blind Dave's Glass Eye Disco coming up?
Yeah, actually we do. It's going to be here in Albuquerque at Vinny's Barbershop.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm going to go to it. there's going to be a lot of bands there and stuff.
You going to do, like, Guns N' Roses and show up, like, 4 hours late?
Yeah, I'm thinking about it, actually.
I'll just pull up in your limo, like, right as if people are starting to leave.
Yeah.
The fuckers can't hang.
Yeah.
You got on your big, giant white fur coat, and as you open up your limo doors, just smoke pours out. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
I wish I could be there.
Yeah, that would be cool. Are we ever going to see you again, bud?
Well, it's such a question. I'm trying to go on my honeymoon. We're trying to figure out when we're going to be able to go and when money aligns to let us go where we want to go. So we're kind of poking around, seeing what happens here. And, Jesus, I wish I could give you some kind of an inkling as when I'm going to see you guys again. Maybe
yeah,
in
we
hell.
Wish we could
I'll
have made your
hell.
Wedding. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if I can get you to read. Would you like to read anything? Or?
Yeah, I think I could read something. I had to change locations from our apartment up in the attic to downstairs because of the phone connection. But now I've got traffic noises and I'm out in front of people, so I'm trying to gauge what I'd like to read and give those considerations. Let's see.
Your traffic sounds better than my traffic.
Yeah.
Yeah, my traffic is lame. It's usually like somebody on a bicycle, a New York yuppie scumbag on a bicycle screaming because somebody's opening a car door right in front of them, you know?
Oh. Yeah, we might have, there's going to be a lot of motorcycles riding by. Supposedly there's going to be a big biker showdown here between the Bandidos and the Vagos. Bikers are coming in from all the surrounding states to have a turf battle. So
awesome.
That could happen while I'm on the phone with you. So just to let you know.
Yeah, if all of a sudden you hang up, I know you'll be just taking video that you'll post on, you know, wherever for us to enjoy.
Yes. Okay. I think I found something here.
Cool.
Okay, let's see. Eventually, Ashley tried to talk Stacy and Katie into becoming topless dancers as well. Stacy's body dysmorphia was taken into account. Hell no, she said. I'm too fat. She'd lost a bit of weight since high school, but still had a pair of 40D tits. Katie was more receptive to the idea. Ashley swore it would be much more rewarding than her humiliating job as an assistant manager for Hot Dog on a Stick at the Metro Center Mall, where she wore a polyester rainbow uniform and a hot dog-shaped derby hat, mixing lemonade by hopping up and down on a pogo stick. After considering her future career path, Katie began thinking that being a cocktail waitress wouldn't be so bad, at least until she made it into the dressing room and became visibly uncomfortable by the dancers changing their costumes and painting their nipples with liquid latex. Shortly after Katie gave Seamus Ross DeVos up for adoption and enrolled in community college, she informed Ashley that, "I hate what you're doing with your life." Ashley didn't care because she had a new friend in Rachel, a friend very comfortable on stage and professionally trained in tap, ballet, and modern dance. Rachel's boyfriend was an Arizona redneck named Matt. He drove a red Ford F-50 with a Confederate Army flag hanging across the back window. Early in life, Rachel's mother saw her daughter's potential. She was dragged to commercial auditions and entered into beauty pageants not long after learning how to walk. Jack was a clean-cut, wholesome-looking guy who easily won the approval of Linda and Richard. After feeling each other out at one of Rachel's parties, Jack and Ashley decided to get an apartment together. He wanted to marry Ashley, adopt her daughter, and produce blonde-haired, blue-eyed grandchildren for his mother as soon as possible. Every day the alarm went off at 5:30, and Ashley put on pantyhose and drove 45 sweaty minutes from Glendale to the Chase Bank Tower in downtown Phoenix. Her new job started to get boring. There were no guys she would be interested in flirting with, even if she were single. And there were no women for her to gossip with, only old maids who played country music on clock radios they kept on their desks. The only thing that Ashley looked forward to were her breaks in the cafeteria, where they sold wonderful pastries, sandwiches, and breakfast burritos. She gained 10 pounds in a month, and when it began to show, the extra weight negated all the hard work she put in during her dancing career. Even Linda had previously noticed Ashley's toned physique. "You look gorgeous. You've never been prettier." And now it was all slipping away. Jack liked to party only on the weekends with the 12-pack of Coors Light. During the week, he worked long hours and complained about the sugar helper she made for dinner. She could also make ground beef into tacos and spaghetti, but Jack always had a remark involving his mother's cooking, and Ashley's food didn't compare. Jack was nice-looking. Both of their families loved the Olin Mills photos they sent for Christmas that year. Before Jack, her only real boyfriend had been Sam. There are many differences between the two men. Naively ignoring this fact, Ashley did not know that being a Danzig fan was a maker or breaker for the relationship. Ashley loved Danzig, Nitzer Ebb, and Sisters of Mercy. In between playlists, he'd often call his mother to intervene in the ensuing argument. He told her about everything, the shake-and-bake chicken, the spaghetti sauce, the extra weight, and the crying baby, even about Ashley pretending to work at the bank, coming home smelling like cigarettes with $250 of fives and ones in hand. And that's it.
And that's just a little glimpse at the portion of the middle of Blind Date to Glass Eye Disco. And I got to say that I hope everybody checks that book out, because it's really... I'm sure it kind of came across how funny it is, and how it talks about real life in just like a really entertaining kind of way. I don't know. What do you got planned next?
Oh, I think a nap, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me too.
I mean, I should party down and stuff, but I'm going on like 3 hours of sleep right now, so.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show and for reading from that book, and it was a lot of fun having you.
Well, thank you, Bud, and I just wanted to say also thank you for all the hard work that you did at putting it together. I couldn't have done it without you or Frankie.
You guys are the best, and I hope you have a good nap there, Lindsay Thomas. Until next time.
All right, you take care, Bud.
I will.
All right.
Bye. Anyway. Bye. So yeah, that's the show for today. That's all I have for you guys today. Thanks for listening. Thanks to both guests, Jen Knox, read that excellent story about Rattle, and thank you again to Lindsay Thomas. Check out her book, Blind Date to Glass Eye Disco, and I'll leave you with that.